Hello, and welcome back to Car Chum. This week, Mike and I attempt to right the wrongs of last week's show, where we ended up talking about trains instead of the intended subject, near misses. Cars and designs that promised oh so much and delivered oh so little. Much like this week's Car Chum, really. What's that on your t-shirt, Mike?
Bring back the Ford Escort manual, but I'm never sure if it's manual gearbox or manual as in workshop manual. But it was a gift, you know.
September 80 to September 90.
Yeah, that'll be helpful if I ever talk about escorts and I happen to be wearing this. That's Mark 3.
And
4 was...
No, hang on. It's Mark 3 and Mark 4, isn't it?
It was Mark 4. Mark 5 wasn't 90, was it?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, of course, Focus came in about 90.
Yeah. So that's Mark 3 and Mark 4, because the Mark 4 was, despite the fact it looked fairly different, was really only a tidy-up and refresh of the Mark 3.
Yeah, it was basically new indicators, new bonnet, bumpers, tail lights. But essentially, I think the centre of the interior, yeah. But a refresh on the
new car.
I mean, effectively, like the Mark 1 and the Mark 2, it took me years to realise were essentially the same car. I mean, particularly the Mark 2 Escort Estate, it was really obvious that that was basically a Mark 1 with a new front.
It had the same kind of Coke bottle rear wings, didn't it?
I mean, if you look at a Mark 2 four-door saloon versus a Mark 1, very different looking cars. Mm-hmm. But the Estate was basically the Mark 1 Estate rear with a Mark 2 front and other changes. Anyway, that's 2 minutes where we've gone off the point.
Good. Ow.
What did you do?
Wait a minute. I just did a full-scale headbutt of the microphone.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. That's nice. Nothing if not professional.
So, nothing.
Nothing.
And not professional. Yeah.
So what's today's topic, Tony? Hey, Tony, what's the topic? There's a catchphrase that won't be.
It's supposed to be what last week was supposed to be. I've absolutely no idea. It's been a week since I listened back to what we recorded last week, and if you asked me what was in it, I'd really struggle to tell you. I know that Cuba was mentioned.
We talked about trains. That was good. I love that.
Of course.
We talked about trains and many other things we know nothing of. No, it was varied.
The plan for me last week was that we'd talk about, because I called it Close But No Cigar, which is what I'm going to call today's as well, because it saves thinking
of another
time.
We're talking about Cuba again then, are we?
It is actually.
Well,
good
I thought
point.
That was. I thought you were that clever. Obviously not.
No. Cars that kind of missed the mark, you know, that either personally or in terms of the success they should have been, but just absolutely weren't. Or cars that you bought yourself and you thought, this is going to be perfect. And then all of a sudden you think, it's not quite as good as I thought it was.
Oh. I interpreted this in a slightly different way. Yeah, I did this in a slightly different way. This is a problem of emailing topics to each other rather than discussing them.
What was yours? Let's see if we can just meld the two together.
I've done cars that I've driven that miss the mark, mainly because they had annoying things on them that really made me hate them. And then I've got sort of one or two that people think are wonderful but were quite flawed. So it might work. Yeah,
let me start the proceedings off.
I'll see if I can. Yeah, you start playing and I'll join in when I recognise the tune.
My most recent one is probably the pinnacle of my disappointment ever. So the new shape Ford Mustang, the S550 shape.
Now, what kind of year are we talking? Because when you say new shape, there is a new Mustang, isn't there?
Yeah, I'm talking 2017. Yeah. So it is the new shape, but just slightly, they revised it 2018, I think, with slightly different shape tail lights. Instead of straight, the straight claws, they're slightly sort of bracketed. Yeah. But things like that. And they digi dash and whatnot. But anyway, this was just pre that. We're going back a couple of years. So I bought it very, very nearly new in Ford do a ruby red metallic at the moment, which is absolutely sensational. It's like the Mazda red we've talked about before, but the Ford ruby red is lovely. Even when you see like a Focus, or can't think of anything else that I've seen one in, but you know, certainly a Focus in it, you think, sheesh, that's, you know, that really looks good.
It's just like a pearlescent deep ruby red, is it?
Yes. Yeah. So the deep ruby pearlescent red with black wheels and whatnot. It's slightly lowered, but it was all done, you know, in Ford dealer. Only done a few miles. Lovely, lovely car. 5 litre manual. It had a flaw. And it wasn't... Well, I kind of noticed it when I was test driving it, but you know, despite the number of cars I've bought, you'd think I'd have learned by now. I kind of liked it so much that I forgave the flaw, and that's not a good thing to do. So it had how do you pronounce it? I think Roush.
Yeah, Roush.
The tuning. Yeah, Roush. Had Roush back boxes on it, which were very loud.
Which is the American tuner in the equivalent of sort of AMG is to Mercedes or Motorsport is to BMW.
Yes.
They're one of several tuners that work on Mustangs. Yeah, and they tend to be engine upgrades and performance upgrades. Just to put people in the picture.
So it had a mild chip, so it had been slightly breathed on by Roush, and the back boxes. I'm not certain that the neighbours loved them when I used to get up for work at 4 in the morning. It was noisy. Now, that sounds ridiculous, but it wasn't the exhaust noise. It had a fundamental flaw, and that was road noise. Mm. Absolutely hideous. I mean, really, really grim. Now, I had it days before I really just couldn't take any more. It was all right up to about 30 miles an hour. I kid you not, 30 miles an hour. Anything beyond that, this sort of hollow roar which resonated with the cabin. So you could really barely talk, in all honesty. So tires.
Well, I was going to say, was this a tire issue? Yeah, was this road noise thrumming
exactly
from the tires?
So did a bit of research. You know the modern tire specifications, the EU. You know, they have to quote wet weather stopping ability, and one of the specs is noise. Now I find consistently that Dunlops are actually rated as the quietest. Of course, whether they are in reality, I know is you know, a different matter, but at least you've got something to go on here. And these were several decibels quieter than anything else, the Dunlops. So I went with a set of Dunlops, put a set of four new Dunlops on it, replacing the Pirellis.
Mm.
What do you think? Did it make a difference?
Made it louder?
I don't think it made difference at all.
None.
So we then went exploring further. It had some anti-tramp bars on it to stop the back axle
tramping.
They kind of connect chassis to suspension arm, so you know that would be a good culprit. Thought, yeah, we're really onto something here. Took them off. Do you think it made any difference?
Yes, it transformed the car.
Nope, it made no difference.
It suddenly handled. Because that was what it had been waiting for all its life, was a handling modification to be removed. Was this a new enough Mustang that it had the independent rear suspension?
Yes.
Yeah, so it was, because they started putting it on sort of about 6 years ago, didn't they, finally? I finally thought, wait a minute, every other car manufacturer on the planet's doing independent rear suspension. Why? Should we? Nah.
Should we have a look at that?
Think about it. Nah.
Newfangled. A bit like Rolls-Royce with disc brakes.
Mm.
Not till they don't squeak. But I don't know that was Ford's logic on the back axle.
So did you solve the problem then?
No, I then changed the slightly lowered suspension to stock. Back to stock standard springs, which I have to say didn't look as nice because it raised it back about an inch. It didn't look as good, but the ride handling combination was for me, for a road car, much better in reality. You know, that look, manufacturers don't get everything right all the time, but it's not for no reason that they spend, you know, billions on development.
Yes.
And come up with a decent compromise between handling and ride and, you know, ability to go over speed bumps and potholes and all the rest.
Yes.
Of it. And if you think honestly that you can do that much better and keep the same set of compromises for 500 quid's worth of springs, you're wrong. You know, if your ultimate aim is to get it not to roll so much in a corner and be stiffer and all the rest of it, then yes, you can succeed at that. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. For 500 quid. But then there is a trade. There is always a trade. And anyway, change the springs. Do you think that made any difference to the road noise?
You're asking me again. One of these has got to be yes, isn't it? Yes.
No. Oh. Do you know what did make a difference to the road noise?
Selling the
correct
car and buying something normal.
Yeah, I spent a lot of money on this Mustang and I loved it for about 3 weeks.
Oh.
And then that was it.
Mm. Oh.
So I don't know whether, and this is interesting to me anyway, having cost me so dear, whether that was a unique quirk to that car, because I did drive lots of other Mustangs at the time. In fact, I've even rented one for a couple of weeks in America. Never had that problem with that S550. So I wonder if that was unique to that car. I have Googled it, looked it up. There are people talking about problems in America, you know, with road noise, etc. But of course, the problem with noise is it's so subjective.
Yeah, that's strange, because I've driven a few. I mean, I've probably, of that era of Mustang, I've maybe driven five or six, including a Roush. I'm trying to think what they all were. Yeah. Now. Certainly a Shelby. I think I drove a Bullet Edition. Yeah, I've driven a few. And largely what I got back was the V8 noise.
Yes.
I don't remember driving one and thinking I couldn't live with this. And I did, you know, sort of play with the performance a bit, and I also did a little bit of round town driving. I've driven the newest shape one, the four cylinder, the 2.3 turbo. And
oh yes, yeah. What's that like? What's the engine
bad.
Like?
Really, all you're missing is the V8 soundtrack. And you do sort of drive around with people people look at the front wings as you drive by to see if you've got the 5.0 badge, to see if you're V8 or not.
Yeah, of course.
But unless you're doing high RPM, you don't particularly hear the V8 that much anyway from inside. Wasn't bad.
Still there though, isn't it, Mike?
I mean,
it's
not a V8, and you kind of buy a Mustang because you want a performance car. You're not buying the days of buying a Mustang because you just want a Ford to get you from A to B. I mean, maybe that's the case in America, but certainly the rest of the world, people buy a Mustang because they're making a statement. They want a Mustang. If you're going to buy a Mustang, it really does need to be a V8. I mean, I drive automatics. I don't have a problem with manual or auto. I fully understand, you know, if you're going to be in traffic for 3 hours a day, why would you necessarily want a manual gearbox and the constant strain of a clutch? But you kind of do want a V8 unless you're in an environment where you just need to buy a Mustang. But the 2.3 is not that big a compromise. It's far less than I expected.
Okay, interesting.
And the Mustang's a heavy car compared to the Focus, which the 2.3 came from. Did you find that? Am I right in thinking you had an older Mustang at one point?
Yeah, I had a 65.
Yeah. Did you find that the new Mustang's about twice the weight of the old one?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, other than the name, I mean, they have absolutely zero in common, don't they? I mean, you know, that applies to any car, doesn't it? We're talking about Escorts earlier, you know, with your T-shirt. You know, if you look at an Escort and compare it to a new Focus now, I mean, they're supposed to be the same class of car, aren't they? But, you know, but cars grow, safety kit, yada, yada.
But that's
how much...
This is what's always surprised me about It sounds like a stupid sentence to say what's always surprised me about American cars is how big and heavy they are. But in terms of modern American cars, I've driven older American stuff. Mm-hmm. And even the big 50s stuff, I mean, it feels old and it's not lively and responsive, although there are exceptions. But the new stuff always feels big and heavy. With power steering, with power brakes, with all the... They're not a modern accoutrement, you got those in the 50s. But certainly with all the assists and things on a modern American car, they still feel really big. And they still feel like you're fighting them in a way that you don't tend to get with smaller cars. They just feel wide and heavy that you don't get with a big Merc or you don't get with a big BMW. Not to the same extent, anyway.
Agreed. The Mustang was wide. Just before you said wide, I was going to say it felt wide. It always felt wide. And I think, I don't know, measurement-wise, whether it is particularly, but I agree with you, it did feel wide, yeah. I mean, it wasn't a small, sporty car.
Before anyone thinks, Mike's just used to driving small European things. I mean, I've driven big cars. I've driven big American pickups. Chevy Blazers, I've driven Ford F-Series 150s, 250s, 350 long wheelbase crew cabs, Dodge Rams, and they are big vehicles. I've done three-point turns in a long wheelbase Dodge Ram in a country lane. It's a large, large truck, but it doesn't feel like you're hauling around as much weight as you sometimes do in something like a new Challenger. I drove a Challenger Hellcat. It's a fabulous car. It's a fabulous experience. And it's great. And they do pick up their skirts and go. They are still a big, heavy car.
Yeah, the Challenger in particular, though, is a hefty device. It always has been.
And I love them. You know, I think they're great. I think it's a wonderful thing that we are still... Well, I say we. We as a world, as a planet, are still making cars like that. Where they are a dirty word, really, aren't they? I mean, performance is a dirty word for modern cars. I love the fact that the Hellcat was conceived and was made. But the entire time I was driving it, I kept thinking, what a wonderful drivetrain. I wonder how this would feel in an old Challenger from the 70s. And I've driven an old Challenger as well. And that was really, really nice. I drove a 70 Challenger with a 340 in it. It wasn't the 440, but it was a 340. And it was great. I could have driven that all day. It was light and responsive. It was all the things that you would want from a daily driver. And it sounded great too. The fact that it was white and it looked like the car from Vanishing Point, it looked like the Kowalski Challenger, it was even better. But it was a lovely car. It was light steering. It had manual steering. It wasn't power. It had manual brakes, and it just felt right. Everything about it, even the size. I felt like I could have taken it into a supermarket car park. And that was what's lacking from the new Challenger. It's just too damn big. Now, this is personal taste. You know, I realise people are buying these, were buying these things left and right, and there's loads of them out there. But for my mind, if you've driven the original version of a car, and then you drive the bigger version, same with the Beetle. Drive a new Beetle versus drive an original Beetle. And just the size is incredible. The extra size, the extra weight.
Yeah, but that's only a name there, though, isn't it? I mean, there's no lineage there.
Well, it's the same with all of them, really. I don't think there's one car that's been built and upgraded and can really trace its roots directly with parts. I mean, you say that with any Ford, you'd certainly say that with the Challenger. I doubt that there's a single bolt that's shared between a 70 Challenger and a 2000 Challenger. I don't know. Maybe there is.
Anyway, so that was the Mustang. Now every time I pass one, I look at it and think, did I just get the most unlucky with a car I've ever gotten? Or is it a thing?
I wonder, because obviously you've had other performance vehicles.
I know. I need to go and drive another one, really, just to lay that one to rest. Right. What's your first one?
I'm driving a newish Peugeot. Great looking car. But I'm doing like a sort of a test drive thing on it. Heading down a narrow lane, and there's a car coming towards me. So I steer slightly to the left, towards the curb, to avoid the oncoming vehicle. And this damn thing took the steering out of my control and steered me back to the centre of the road. Because it thinks you're about to hit the side of the road. And it's sort of beep, 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 and it steers off to the right, into oncoming traffic. At that point, I was very tempted to drive into a field and set fire to it. Because I hate anything like that. And this is my rant. It's things that they decide, oh, let's make it safer by installing something that outthinks the human being. Now, if you're the sort of person who drives drunk, then yes, you need something on your car that stops you from making stupid decisions like that. Or if you're so terrible at driving that you can't park and you need the car to park for you, then you shouldn't be driving, or you shouldn't be owning a vehicle that size. But, and this happened on another car, this happened on a Seat. It was a new Seat. We're driving along, and it had the automatic braking. And a car was coming out of a turning in front and left it a little bit too late. So instinctively, you brake. And by the time we got the brake down, 2 seconds later, the car went, oh, there's a problem, and jammed on the brakes full. At which point, we're already slowing. So we then went from slowing to a full-on emergency stop. By which point the danger had passed,
except for the danger from the rear.
With that.
Okay, that's interesting. Nothing.
Excellent. No. Hooray! Well, that was worth it.
Nothing.
That was worth Tony speechless.
No, well, it's never been something that's.
Tony's on the phone to our sponsor this week, Peugeot.
Bendix brakes.
All right, there's another device then. I had a hire car. We normally got Ford Focuses where I worked, but somebody important had ordered a Subaru Forester for whatever it was they were doing, someone higher up in management. And the company had thought, oh, it's easy to just give me the Subaru the following day than it is to take back the Subaru and put a Focus in its place. So I had this Subaru Forester delivered to my house. And I thought, oh, that's cool, you know. Hadn't driven many Subarus, and it was quite a neat-looking thing. I mean, my first thought, you know, Mr. Exciting here, my first thought was, that's going to be thirsty on fuel. But, because, you know, that's the exciting way I roll when I'm given a new car. Ooh, MPG's going to be awful on that. But I had a look at it, and it was fine. You know, it was left outside the house. So the next morning, ready to go, off to my meeting. Get in, put the key in the ignition, turn the key, nothing happens. Okay. So we've got to do some sort of startup thing, clearly.
Yeah.
Play with the gear stick, make sure it's in neutral, turn the key, nothing happened. Seatbelt on, nothing happened. Okay, there's not an immobiliser on it that I can see. There's certainly no buttons, nothing's flashing. Okay, foot on the brake pedal. Nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right. Gonna have to go with the go through the manual then, you know. Thank you for buying a Subaru Forester.
Yeah.
La, 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 la.
Yeah. Congratulations on the purchase of your new Subaru Forester. With care and attention, it should give you years.
You now own a car with horrendous MPG. But yeah, I know that. Flick, 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 flick. Page 67. How to start your Subaru. Page 67. Time's a wasting.
Imagine all the fun you've had in 66 pages before.
Page 67. Make sure it's in neutral. Turn the key. Put down the brake pedal to the floor and the clutch pedal to the floor. Then turn the key.
Both?
Yes. Then it starts.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Clutch is, is common.
But clutch and brake together. Make sure it's in neutral. Turn the key. I think there was some sort of mantra as well. You had to chant in Japanese, and you had to light some incense. But I just think I own old cars for the simple reason that if you get in and turn the key and nothing happens, chances are you're either out of petrol or someone's stolen your battery. You don't have to perform some form of black magic ritual and put both hands in your pockets and walk backwards around the car before the freaking thing will start.
Have you never... But hang on. Have you never... I'm going to play devil's advocate. Can you honestly, hand on heart, say you have not ever turned the starter key on a manual car with it in gear?
I mean, only when somebody else has parked it.
Yeah, but regardless, you've done it, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah. I managed to back into the other car I own doing that.
Exactly. So hang on, you are arguing against something here that actually would have saved that occurring.
But what you're missing here is the fact that that car started, and I was on my way, bumperless, but I was on my way.
It started the one behind as well. I mean, that, pushed it down the street.
That's an interesting one for the insurance company. Did you see who did it? Yeah, I was there. Have you got his insurance details? Yes, and so have you. Yeah,
idiot.
Well, it's two lots of insurance there. Sky high. No, to be fair, it didn't actually do that much damage. It just lunged towards the other car. But yeah, no, I've done it. I've started cars in gear before. You know, we probably all have. But
I always leave any manual, and I, you know, mainly have manuals, but well, mixture, I suppose. But I always leave in gear. Do you?
Depends. Depends on the car. But don't trust the handbrake, or it's a particularly steep hill, then yeah, I will often leave it in third, because I think there's less chance of it rolling. But then I owned an old Volvo 240 that would just roll away in gear. This was how I realised the engine needed a rebuild, was I put it in third at the top of a hill, and it went and started rolling down the hill, like a learner, sort of bumping its way down in third.
Yeah,
I put it in fourth, and it
great,
still did.
Great
it. So
compression
the engine was
ratio.
Engine compression was about 0.01. But yeah,
more pressure in your tyres.
Absolutely, yeah. There's more. You know, I think I could have probably whistled into the engine and increased the pressure. But yeah, that's. I don't know if this is actually on the point of what you wanted to talk about, but yeah, basically modern cars that really. Everything on modern cars annoys me.
I've got another near miss, and this is an earlier one. Cavalier Mark II, right? And this is a very specific model, not the whole Mark II, because it was actually quite a nice car, the Opel Ascona. So this is a family one, actually. A family member, a great relative, with a capital G, had from new a Cavalier, a saloon, which I always thought was a bit odd on the Cavalier. The Cavalier should have been a hatch. I mean, and it was, but any Cavalier should have been a hatch.
Was.
I think it just sits.
that would be like the Cavalier hatchback, you mean? Like the. Now, what did they. Sports hatch.
The sport that was on the Mark One,
yeah.
But the Mark Two, so it just looked better, and it, I don't know. There's nothing wrong with the saloon; it's not ugly or anything. But it just, I don't know. I'd feel cheated because it should be a hatch.
Two door or four door?
Do you know what I mean?
In this case, because they did
four door. They were all four doors.
Maybe not on the Mark One,
Mark Two,
but they certainly did do a two door Cavalier because that's what they based the convertibles on.
Yeah. Oh, good point.
Yeah, no, they did. I'm sure you
good
could
point,
buy a
good
Mark
point,
One saloon
good point. They,
in hatch and saloon, but I hope your point wasn't about to be they should have made
Mark
them two door, but they didn't. Have I just ruined that?
Totally ruined. No, hang on. We're getting muddled. The Mark II, there was a convertible.
Yes.
But I don't think there was a two door saloon.
I think there was.
Certainly not in Vauxhall. But you're looking up.
I am
books.
Actually wondering how if I can grab like the Observer's Book of Cars and what year I ought to go for. I'm sure there was
88, 89, 90.
Oh, 90s. So like the Mark II as a two door.
Yes. Which is why I said the
no,
Mark
that
II
would have been the Manta
several times,
wouldn't it?
No, the Manta was the Mark I.
Did they not do a Mark II Manta in the '80s?
No.
Well, it's going to be fun to edit, isn't it?
No.
What I'd say is scrap this entire piece.
Be quick. I was going to say it'll be quick.
Delete.
Anyway, this was
make your point and maybe we can salvage something from this.
Okay. Yeah. The point was the specification that my great relative bought. He was not interested in cars at all. Someone less interested in cars, impossible to find, right? And I've got another story about that involving a Hillman, but I'll save that for another day. But a Cavalier, he bought the 1.3 L four-speed saloon because it was the cheap. Can you imagine sitting down with the brochure? Well, I don't suppose he did. I expect he just said, "I'll have the cheapest one of them, please." But can you imagine looking at the brochure and going, "Oh, wait a minute, I could have comfortable seats or I could have itchy ones." Yeah, I'll have the itchy ones. I could have a five-speed gearbox like every other car in the world by this point, or I could have... I'll go for the four-speed. Yep, definitely. That'll be good on the motorway. Wait a minute, engine. Yes, a 1.3. That's what I need. Not the Family 2 engine, you know, the 1.6 and 2 litre that were rather nice. I'll have the 1.3.
It's really quite scary sometimes how basic a lot of cars were. I mean, I tend to go back to my knowledge of American stuff because it's what I know the most about, because clearly I don't know anything about Vauxhalls. But you could buy Studebaker, always offered cheap, simple cars. And they're horrendously racist sounding now, but their cheapest thrift model was called the Scotsman. Genuinely.
Right.
The Studebaker Scotsman.
Wow.
And everything was an option on that. You can look it up. But it was even things like sun visors were an option.
Right. Wow.
And typically, the what they called the stripper cars, but basically everything was stripped off on them, which they'd sell to sort of business people. And you would just get one sun visor. Because the second one cost another couple of dollars, and if you weren't ever taking passengers, you were just a salesman on your own. Why would you need more than one sun visor? Why would you need more than one mirror?
But I tell you what, this wasn't that uncommon, of course, with German cars, Mercedes, BMW. Well, Mercedes were the pinnacle of it. You know, right the way into the early 90s, you know, you didn't even get a blooming radio.
Yeah.
You had to get your Blaupunkt. I'm trying to think of a Montreal.
A friend of mine's just sold a 78 Mercedes W123, and that had just the one mirror on the driver's side. It had a blank on the passenger side.
Yeah.
I can't do without a passenger mirror now.
No. Oh, I can't do with it, but I also can't be doing not to have it as well, because it looks... It's the symmetry is just...
Oh,
no.
That doesn't bother me.
No. It's because...
I mean, do you put two radio aerials on a car, then?
No.
Do you put two badges on
Good
the
point.
Boot? So it's got Ford on, you know, on both sides, and then put Escort above or below it. So it's... I
tell you what, name a car, Mike. There's one that I can think of that had symmetrical double brand badges on the back.
BMW M1.
Yeah. Correct.
Yes. The only Although I think there has been another one since. But yes, fabulous trivia. Yes, the BMW M1 had a badge on each corner.
I was pleased with that. I followed one the other day. The reason I know is I followed one on the motorway M25 around London.
Wow.
We didn't go all the way around London. Obviously, that would be ridiculous. But it was in white, and it was lovely, very nice condition, but clearly... a user.
Wow.
Well, that's what it looked like. It looked like it, you know, it had brake dust on the fronts, and, you know, it wasn't something that was just being taken out to a show. It was midweek anyway. And it was just sitting in the outside lane. Yeah.
And of course,
we are really striking.
Talking about the 70, the 80s supercar, not like the 1 Series M that you can get.
Oh, yeah.
In case people are perplexed, thinking, oh, I've got.
Yeah, the 116i with M Sport badge
I've
on
got a 135. Yeah. It's only got one badge on it. Yeah, you've not been...
Anyway, so that Cavalier... No, the Cavalier, I really liked that... I really wanted to like that Cavalier. I liked the seats. The dash was quite nice. The fit and finish was good. You know, it was a good car, actually. But I never... wanted it, because if only it had been, it didn't even need to be the GL, just the 1600 hatch.
Yeah.
You know, And then that would have transformed it. And I'd have said, you know, when you're finished with that, I'll have that, please. But the 1.3 four-speed.
It is one of those aspects of a car, and we have touched on this before, that if you buy the base model and you don't have any options, you do tend to get a dashboard full of blanks where there should be buttons as a constant reminder that you should have popped for electric mirrors and electric windows. Or a friend of mine had a Triumph 2000 Mark II that didn't have hazard lights. As late as 1974, right, it would appear that hazard lights were an option.
Yeah,
because we looked all over the...
They were.
When it broke down, we looked everywhere for hazard lights. It's standing by the side of the road. I think it apparently doesn't have them, which surprised me. 1974, you'd think by then there was some sort of legislation that would have demanded them.
It was I've read this at some point. It was mandated later than that, I think. But yes, I mean, there came a point where you had to have it. And
I had them on my Mark 1. I had a 1969 Mark 1 Triumph 2000, and that had them. So hence, we were expecting they would be on a 74, a five-year newer car, but obviously not.
I'm wondering if they were aftermarket or an owner edition on the Mark 1.
Don't think so, because I saw the similar setup on other Mark 1s. But I do wonder if perhaps it was an option.
You used to be able to buy kits, though. That's Mike. True. And back in the 60s, and the kits were quite convincing because they had the same kind of style switches. Yeah.
Can I, since we touched on supercars, can I bring up the Lamborghini Countach, or Countach, depending on how you want to pronounce it? We're talking about the mid-70s, the LP 4500, you know, the classic Countach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the rear wing. Do you know the story of the rear wings on these cars?
No, but the rear wings only came in later, didn't they? Because the earlier ones were more...
Ordinary. We're talking about the wide...
it's one of those ordinary Lamborghinis.
we're talking about the Cannonball Run style. The flared arch kind of ones. So they basically... And I've lost the guy's name, but there was a Formula One manager. And Lamborghini, he'd bought a Countach, and they designed this rear wing purely as a one-off for him. And he thought, oh, that's fabulous. Right. Yes, I definitely want that. So they put it on his car. They hadn't homologated it. So this wasn't something that they could offer as a direct option on the car. So they used to install them. If you wanted the spoiler on the car or the rear airfoil, they would put it on in the car park outside and literally drill holes in a brand new Lamborghini and install the wing. The thing with the wing was, and it cost around £5,000 or the equivalent at the time, this is a piece of aluminium with foam in the centre. So it used to corrode. Not rust, but corrode. The Countach apparently never saw a wind tunnel at all. This was just the design that they penned and thought, that looks nice. So it's got a coefficient drag factor of 0.42. Now, that probably doesn't...
Doesn't
perhaps mean a great deal to many people, but the higher the number, the worse it is. So a Countach, 0.42 drag coefficient. A transit van is 0.37. A Ford Transit van is more aerodynamic than a Lamborghini Countach. The other problem they had, obviously, massive V12 engine in the back, so it used to, under acceleration, would lift the front of the car, obviously, would make the front end very, very light and take all the weight off the front, which adversely affected the handling. So putting the spoiler on the back made that even worse because it added to the downforce. It took even more weight off the front wheels and put it more on the back, which sounds fine for acceleration, but, I mean, these were fairly quick cars anyway. So realising that it made the handling even worse, they dialed in the spoilers to have absolutely zero effect on aerodynamics. So, in fact, all the spoiler did was cost you £5,000 and take at least 11 miles an hour off the top speed because of the extra drag. But when you see these cars, you can't imagine them without a spoiler.
No. As I say, other than the early ones I don't think were quite as bejeweled as the later ones. With the telly dial wheels and whatnot. Yes. Is that what they were called?
What you mean with the five holes. I mean, incredible looking car, which is obviously what Lamborghini intended to do.
But a lot of supercars suffer from relatively poor drag figures anyway, which is sort of counterintuitive. Mm. But they suffer, of course, because they tend to be quite wide. They tend to have big spoilers for downforce at speed. And, of course, if you're creating downforce, you're using the wind. You are, therefore, creating drag. Big wide tyres.
Yes, which are about a foot wide on the back of...
yes.
Gigantic.
Three somethings, yeah.
But I always like that. I mean, it's a car I love because it's so flawed. As obviously were many of these cars. Apparently they're horrendous to drive. I've never been... I've sat in one. I've never driven one.
Did you manage to get in all right? Because they're quite a...
No, you basically kind of get in and out as you would a rabbit hutch that was on fire. You know, there's a sense of urgency, but it's also extremely difficult. So there is no elegant way to get in and out of any of these guys. You barely get in and out of a Mini. You do it like they taught the ladies. You keep your knees together and swing your sort of body around and get out. You know, deportment. If you can do it with a book on your head, it's even better. But no.
Here's another one that I think I quite fancy, actually, and I'll pick this one as my last one, because I reckon you'll have a bit of sympathy with this. Yeah. A Matra Ranchero.
Yes. Yes.
What do you think to that?
Oh, they're wonderful.
Aren't they great? So, a Matra Ranchero, built from 77 till mid-80s.
Yeah, I think it's 83, I think.
Something like that. If you've never seen one, it's a little bit like a low Discovery Series 1. Would that be fair?
Yes, mated with a Pope Mobile.
Yeah, yes. So they took the Simca 1100 front end, round headlights, just a normal kind of saloon car, and then grafted on the back in genuine plastic. Mm. Partly plastic, that's slightly unfair. A sort of pseudo SUV kind of body on the back. This was genius, this car. This foresaw the market of 2005, 2010 onwards in 1977.
Yeah.
They were producing something that would sell in the last 10 years like absolute hotcakes. It was brilliant. It was relatively cheap to make insofar as development terms anyway, because you were starting with a platform that already existed, the Simca. You were then grafting bits on the back. You could even get... It was only two-wheel drive, but you could get a limited slip diff in it. Now, for most people, that's more than enough off-road ability. sorted in 77.
The thing with it, they, as you say, they took the Simca car, they basically put a van body on the back with a lot of glass, and it looked like a car-based van with a rear body in glass, like a big sort of fish tank. They put on different bumpers front and rear, made it look heftier, and they put wheel arch extensions on, which gave it a really rugged look. They put wider tyres on, which completely ruined the steering, because it was just like a 1.1 car anyway.
I think they upspec the engine, it looked
fantastic. They put spotlights on the front, it looked amazing. That was the big issue. It was not only two-wheel drive, but it was front-wheel drive. Wasn't even rear-wheel drive. And virtually every brochure shot you look at, you will see this car out in the countryside, in a field, in a wooded environment, driving down a muddy trail. apparently virtually every one of these cars got stuck during the photo shoot because they did not have the power to go off-road. They were something like, what, 80 brake horse at most? Yeah.
Yeah,
it was
like
all
that.
The pose. They're a great-looking car. If you'd never seen one but before, you look at a Matra Rancho today, you would think, wow, that's a fantastic-looking off-roader. And why on earth they didn't develop a four-wheel drive system for it, I don't know.
They did. I tell you what they did have to get you out of a spot of bother. You could have a winch on it.
A very, very ineffectual winch. I may be wrong, but I believe somewhere in the recesses of my mind, I seem to recall that the winch wasn't powerful enough to actually take the full weight of the car. But yeah, they anticipated a market about 22 years too early, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. Three rows of seats as well.
Yes.
You know, I mean, this was forward thinking. Do you know what it sired, though? Because it was effectively a failure. But do you know what car came almost directly from that?
Tell me.
The Espace.
Oh, yes, because it was sort of...
It kind of paved the way for the Espace.
They were in bed together, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And the Espace was the first people carrier accessible that people actually wanted.
No.
Oh, it was. No, you're going to talk American, aren't you? But
I'm going to throw things at you like 1983 Dodge Caravan. The car that saved Chrysler.
Yeah.
I'm also going to throw at you Chevrolet Suburban from the late 40s. I'm also going to throw at you Fiat Multipla from the early 50s.
That was... Oh, the first one, yeah.
Yeah, but facts outweigh opinion.
In Europe, nothing captivated the middle class family. It's like the SUV now.
Oh,
like
definitely. In Europe, they bought Espaces. In America and Canada, they bought Dodge Caravans, and never the twain shall meet. You know, the two weren't particularly exported to each other's countries. So, yes, you bought the local variation.
And the name Caravan's silly, because that's clearly something you put on the back and sleep in.
Yeah. They sold, you know, they sold probably more of them than they did as buses. Maybe.
Anyway, so Matra Ranchero, I really like, and I quite fancy one of those, but it was subjectively a flop.
Yes, but still a fabulous car. It's a weird thing. I used to work on a car magazine, and we were always having these sort of debates around the office of four or five of us about, oh, no, that's terrible, that's awful. And one of us brought up the Matra Rancho, and we all went, they're really cool. It's one of about four cars we all agreed on ever that they're so fundamentally flawed. But if you see one, you can't help thinking, I like that. They had a tailgate on the back and a massive rear hatch, which opened sort of Range Rover style. Honestly, if they'd have just got together with somebody like Fiat and borrowed their Panda 4x4 running gear and just jacked the thing up a couple of inches for clearance, I mean, it's probably not quite that simple, but I think they could have had a real, real winner. I mean, it was fiberglass or plastic. So it wouldn't have rotted in the rear half, at least. The front half was still metal, which was another flaw.
It'd be great to write a buyer's guide for one, wouldn't it? You know, areas to look for rust, the back.
Exactly. It's all in the front.
Wait a minute, the wrong way round. Don't let me write it.
That's why we don't let
you
write.
Areas to check for rust, the front. You've got everyone searching the back for rust. It's immaculate. It's in the front.
Do you remember the... I'm going to horrendously mispronounce this, but the Bagari? The Matra Bagari? Which was the three-seater.
Not pronounced like that,
no.
I don't.
Am I thinking of the wrong car here? They did a three-seater in much the same way as the... As the modern McLaren F1, it's not modern anymore. But the McLaren F1,
really,
from the 90s, so you had three seats in the front. Was it Was it Bagheera?
I can't.
I think it was Bagheera.
No, Bagheera was... Oh, yeah, no. The Matra Bagheera. Sort of sporty
car. Yeah, it was like a kind of
car.
Sporty hatchback.
Yes.
But you had three seats in a row. In it.
I didn't know that. I can picture it. Yeah. No, that's right. But I had no idea it had three seats.
Yeah.
Where was the steering?
It was off to the on the left-hand side. It wasn't centre like a McLaren.
Oh, okay.
You just had, rather than like a centre console, you had a third seat. They're all the same size. Much like a transit van. But you didn't have two and one.
You just had
three and like a sofa and like a bench. Or were they?
That's
or could
awesome,
you move
it?
Them? I think they maybe were separate seats. But anyway, yeah, you know, Matra always dancing to the beat of a different drum.
Yes. Sadly, that drum got a rip in it.
Failed. No, it's a pity. They did do some good stuff, and I'm struggling to think what any other car that Matra did. They did they do a turbo at one point. Really, they did.
Well, they did. They did lots of building for other people.
Oh, they did actually. Yeah. Yeah, they did. I've sort of run out here.
Yeah, no. Well, I've got more, but I'm going to save them. Actually.
Well, you always say this, and then you never do. I mean, look, you know what happened to the engine size quiz 2 weeks ago.
Look.
Yeah, it's almost as if you choose topics you've got content for, and I don't.
or either that, or actually do some work.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you give me the idea 10 minutes before we go on air. go on then, wrap this up in a neat little bag then, and we'll put it out for the dustman.
What a line to finish with, Mike. And what a way to close the first season of Car Chum. Fear not though, the break will be short. Not short enough for some, maybe. And there might even be a bit of behind the scenes chat together about the podcast if we get time. Maybe. Then again, maybe we'll end up talking about trains. I'm not even interested in trains.